General, we've never seen an object like this gain entry into our airspace before. How did that happen?
That's an excellent question, Katie. The balloon was somehow able to get past our West Coast anti-balloon defense system, the Seattle Space Needle. But once it was here, we were able to keep an eye on it with our sophisticated tracking technology of going like this.
Our thanks to Saturday Night Live there. There are rising diplomatic tensions, however, between the United States and China after a White House decision to shoot down that massive spy balloon. We'll walk through what happened and take a look at the growing fallout. Plus, a powerful earthquake leaves hundreds of people dead in Turkey and Syria. This morning, rescue crews are searching through the rubble for any survivors. And heading into 2024, Democrats have approved a new primary calendar, reshaping the way the party picks its presidential nominees, but there are still some potential challenges ahead. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early on this Monday, February 6th. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for starting your day and week with us. We'll begin with the latest on that Chinese spy balloon and rising tensions with Beijing over the Biden administration's decision to shoot it down. A senior defense official tells NBC News that the Pentagon has been analyzing the remnants of the balloon over the past few days after it was shot down off the coast of South Carolina on Saturday. According to the Defense Department, the balloon first entered U.S. airspace on January 28th. It then briefly crossed into Canada before re-entering U.S. territory on Tuesday around Idaho and then floating across the Midwest, eventually spotted over Kansas before ending up in South Carolina. Speaking after Saturday's shoot-down operation, President Biden gave new insight into why the balloon wasn't brought down sooner.
On Wednesday, when I was briefed on the balloon, I ordered the Pentagon to shoot it down on Wednesday as soon as possible. Told them to shoot it down.
On Wednesday?
On Wednesday.
But the recommendation
they said to me, let's wait till the safest place to do it.
They waited, in part, so debris wouldn't fall on people on the ground, but also to give them a better chance of recovering it, to study what the Chinese had up there. The violation of international law led to the White House canceling Secretary of State Antony Blinken's planned visit to Beijing last week, which was to have been the first by a cabinet member since the Biden administration took office. It was agreed to by Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping when they met in November in Indonesia. Despite multiple statements from the Chinese government accusing the White House of, quote, overreacting to a so-called weather balloon that drifted off course, U.S. officials have doubled down on their position that the balloon intentionally crossed into North America to, quote, monitor sensitive military sites. In a series of social media posts over the weekend, former President Donald Trump blasted the Biden administration for its response and claimed China respected him too much to carry out similar efforts while he was in office. But according to a senior defense official, similar balloons flew over the U.S. at least three times during the Trump presidency, and none were shot down. Joining us now, executive editor of NewYorker.com, David Rode. David, good morning. Thanks for being with us this morning. I know you spoke to a senior U.S. diplomat about the balloon situation yesterday. Where does this diplomat come down on what China was up to and what it could do in terms of how it may damage that relationship?
This official was surprised. They thought this was sort of a very clumsy and aggressive effort by China to, it seems like, surveil these sensitive military locations in the U.S. And they felt it would help the American effort to sort of counter China and to say to the world, look at how aggressive the Chinese have become. But I do think the main issue for the Biden administration is a domestic political one. As you mentioned, Republicans have really pounced on this or trying to claim that it makes Biden seem weak. There is a long pattern here, and I think the real challenge for Biden is trying to sort of reset this relationship with China. This shows how aggressive China has become and how important it is for the U.S. to have a long-term strategy to counter what is clearly now the world's other superpower.
Yeah, certainly the administration was in a bit of a dilemma here, David. Some senior officials told me over the weekend look, obviously not great. They were unhappy in terms of the political perception that this balloon was over the U.S. for several days. But as we heard from the president, they didn't want to shoot it down where it could, injure or worse, people on the ground. So what are you hearing? Could the administration's response be going forward now that, as you say, Republicans have really pounced on this?
So they, this official I spoke to was sort of surprised. They questioned, was there a mistake that happened here? They said this Chinese official maybe proposed this idea, could be punished for what's happened. But what's interesting is even this morning, there's more rhetoric from China insisting that this was a civilian balloon, which just isn't true. So I think Joe Biden needs to talk about this today. He needs to talk about it in the State of the Union address. He can't be seen as passive. Again, I think the Republicans are exaggerating the threat here, but he needs to lead and show that he will defend the country. It's sort of strange. A balloon, given all the high tech surveillance that's out there, there's a real threat of micro drones. That's sort of the latest technology, which the U.S. has used in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I've seen that, and that right. China could be using that. So it's a big moment for the Biden administration, and they have to be assertive against China now.
And certainly they have their satellites up, too. And David, briefly and lastly, we know from officials that some of this debris has been recovered already off the coast of South Carolina. What do you think they'll find?
I think they'll find, and that's the plus for the United States here. They're going to find what kind of technology they were using. The question is, could this balloon hear things, hear sort of communications and cell phone traffic that a satellite can't detect from space? So they're going to get every bit of that debris, and that's a plus for the United States. This is something that will help us understand Chinese systems and why they're sending these balloons, all over the world.
The New Yorker's David Rode, thank you so much for starting us off this morning. We appreciate it. In other news, after facing bipartisan backlash over President Biden's handling of classified documents, administration officials are offering a closed-door briefing for members of the Gang of Eight. Two sources familiar with the situation tell NBC News the briefing will cover the documents found in the possession of President Biden, former President Donald Trump, and former Vice President Mike Pence. It's a congressional briefing. House Intel Committee Chairman Mike Turner announced the briefing yesterday on Meet the Press and criticized the administration for lacking urgency, he says, on national security matters.
What's striking about this, Chuck, is that the Biden administration told the American public that they raided Donald Trump's home because it was a national security risk. But what we found in the intelligence community and the intelligence committee is that the Biden administration had not engaged at all anyone who was in national security on the issue of threats from these documents. Mm-hmm. It took Congress to step in and say, we want a security threat. And then they tried to deny giving the briefing to us from that threat. What's interesting is that the moment this balloon became public, I got a notice not from the administration that I'm going to get a briefing on this balloon, mm-hmm. but they have to rush to Congress now to talk to us about Donald Trump's documents. You can see they want to change the news.
The Democratic National Committee has adopted a new primary schedule that will dethrone Iowa and New Hampshire as the leadoff states in the party's presidential nominating process. Under the new rules pushed by the Biden administration, South Carolina will go first, then Nevada and New Hampshire, followed by Georgia and Michigan. However, the proposed calendar changes are not yet final. Georgia will need cooperation from Republicans in the state to change the primary date, and officials from both sides of the aisle in New Hampshire are vowing to fight the DNC schedule changes and still hold their primary first. Party officials are giving both states until June 3rd to finalize their own calendars. Coming up, DNC Chairman Jamie Harrison will join Morning Joe to discuss what this means for the party, as well as sharing his thoughts on some New Hampshire officials stonewalling the primary date change. Meanwhile, sad news to report. A prominent American war medic has been killed while volunteering in Ukraine. Pete Reed was a retired Marine and dedicated his life to helping others. In a message on Facebook, Reed's wife wrote that on Thursday, his ambulance was shelled while he was evacuating civilians and that he apparently died while shielding a member of his team with his own body. After leaving the Marines, the 33-year-old from New Jersey volunteered as a medic in Iraq during the fight against ISIS, then headed to Ukraine with an aid group that he founded. Back in 2017, Reed was profiled for his work in Mosul, Iraq, by NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel.
How many frontline medical posts like this are there in Mosul right now? One.
You're standing in it.
Our condolences to his family. Meanwhile, a powerful 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit parts of Turkey and Syria overnight, killing at least 640 people, and hundreds more are still believed to be trapped under the rubble. The epicenter of the quake was in south-central Turkey, home to many Syrian refugees, and the site of one of the largest operations run by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. The part of Syria that was hit is divided between government-held territory and the country's last opposition-held enclave. This is the world's deadliest earthquake since June, when a 5.9 magnitude earthquake killed more than 1,100 people in Afghanistan. We'll have more on that story as it develops. Still ahead, embattled Republican Congressman George Santos is facing new scrutiny once again, this time in the form of a harassment allegation. Plus, Democratic insiders are going all in on Joe Biden in 2024. We'll take a look at the president's message at the Democratic National Committee's winter meeting. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more. Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Welcome back. A former prospective congressional aide is accusing Congressman George Santos of sexual harassment. In a letter posted on Twitter and sent to the House Ethics Committee, Derek Myers accused Congressman Santos of groping him while he briefly worked for the office. He wrote this: "The congressman proceeded to take his hand and move it down my leg into my inner thigh and then proceeded to touch my groin." Myers says his job offer was rescinded days later. NBC News has not independently corroborated the letter's allegations. Myers is also accusing Santos's office of ethics violations, claiming he was hired and then told to work as a volunteer until his payroll paperwork went through. Santos's office did confirm to news outlets that they were in the process of hiring Myers, but they say he was terminated due to concerns over a past charge of wiretapping when he worked as a journalist in Ohio. Last year, Myers published courtroom audio testimony that someone else recorded and sent to him. A spokesperson for Congressman Santos did not immediately respond to NBC News' request for comments about the allegation. A spokesperson for the Ethics Committee ranking member, Congresswoman Susan Wild, has confirmed the committee received the letter but declined any further comment. Meanwhile, along with being a self-proclaimed star college volleyball player, George Santos was also a Broadway producer. At least that's what the embattled lawmaker allegedly told potential donors when he was running for office in 2021. Bloomberg reports Santos told supporters that he was a producer on the short-lived Broadway production Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. That's according to people familiar with the discussions. The office of the play's producer confirmed that Santos did not work on it. The play only ran for a short time and was plagued with technical issues and actor injuries. It lost millions of dollars during its run and, frankly, a curious choice for Santos to lie about. A spokesman for the show said, quote, "Of all the tribulations the producers of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark had to endure, we are very pleased, proud, and relieved to report that working with George Santos was not one of them." Stars did gather in Los Angeles last night for the 65th annual Grammy Awards, celebrating the music industry's biggest hits and many historic moments.
And the Grammy goes to Beyoncé!
Beyonce made history with her record-breaking 32nd Grammy win, holding the most Grammy Awards of any artist of all time. She surpassed Hungarian-British conductor George Solti, whose record of 31 Grammys had stood for more than 20 years. Harry Styles took home the award for Album of the Year for Harry's House. Record of the Year went to Lizzo for About Damn Time. And Song of the Year went to Bonnie Raitt for Just Like That. The multi-time Grammy winner finally won for her songwriting. Best New Artist went to Samara Joy. Viola Davis achieved EGOT status after winning the Grammy for Best Audiobook Narration and Storytelling for her memoir, Finding Me. The show also celebrated 50 years of hip-hop music with a medley of performers from several generations. Still ahead, the Kansas City Chiefs and Philadelphia Eagles have arrived in Arizona ahead of the upcoming Super Bowl. Plus, Kyrie Irving gets his wish. He's traded from the Brooklyn Nets. We'll take a look at where he's headed. Good luck. Sports is next.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Devontae Adams here.
He does. Devontae gets to the pay dirt.
Okay, so that's something that no one expected to see in a contact-free version of the Pro Bowl. Los Angeles Rams quarterback Jalen Ramsey leveling Miami Dolphins receiver Tyreek Hill at the goal line during a flag football game. The whole point of flag football is not to tackle. The Pro Bowl changed its format this season, eliminating the traditional contest because no one cared about it, and replacing it with three flag games played on a 50-yard field and then a series of skills competitions. Each of the first two flag games was worth 6 points, and each skills event was three. The total points were accumulated to form the score entering the final flag game. The AFC had the edge in the skills events, winning 5 of the 8 competitions spread out over 2 days, including the kick-tack-toe and move the chains events yesterday. But the NFC's ability to win 2 of the 3 flag football games made the difference. Minnesota Vikings quarterback Kirk Cousins played better yesterday than he did in the playoffs. He tossed 3 touchdowns in the final flag game, leading the NFC to a 35-33 victory and ending a 5-game Pro Bowl losing streak for the conference. NFC coach Eli Manning received a Gatorade bath for his side's winning effort against the AFC and his brother Peyton Manning. Word is some of the players played harder in the flag football game than they have during the regular contest in recent weeks. The whole thing is pretty confusing, though. The NFL has not committed to a format yet for next year. Meanwhile, a game that actually matters, the Super Bowl. And the two teams playing in it arrived in Arizona yesterday, 1 week before facing off in the big game. The Kansas City Chiefs were the first to touch down in Phoenix. The pilot hung a Chiefs Kingdom flag out of the cockpit window as players, coaches, and staff got off the plane and walked across the runway. The Philadelphia Eagles arrived about an hour later, flying a Philly thing flag. Both teams will participate in a media event tonight before final preparations begin. Super Bowl 57 kicks off this Sunday in Glendale. We will have complete coverage all week long. Turning now to the NBA, where Kyrie Irving's time with the Brooklyn Nets is over. 2 days after the star guard told the team he wanted to be traded by Thursday's league deadline, Irving is reportedly heading to the Dallas Mavericks. In exchange, the Nets will receive 2 players and a package of draft picks. Dallas also gets Markieff Morris in the deal. It marks the end of a drama-filled tenure in Brooklyn for Irving, who played just 143 games and 3+ seasons with the Nets, and only 74 of them with Kevin Durant after their celebrated pairing in the summer of 2019. It's not immediately clear when Irving will make his debut with the Mavs. Let's be clear here. Kyrie Irving, though talented, blew his way out of Cleveland, blew his way out of Boston, now Brooklyn. And of course, there's all this off-the-court baggage, the anti-vax theories, the flat earth stuff, and most damagingly, of course, the anti-Semitic remarks. Good luck to the Dallas Mavericks. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, the Golden State Warriors say Steph Curry is sidelined after an MRI revealed several injuries, including ligament tears to his left leg. ESPN reports Curry will miss at least the next several weeks, expected to be out through the All-Star break later this month and maybe longer. Curry was injured in the third quarter of Saturday night's win over the Dallas Mavericks. Time now for the weather, and let's go to meteorologist Michelle Grossman for the forecast. Noted Philadelphia Eagles fan. Michelle, tell us about the forecast and how you're feeling about the game.
You know, I was just talking to Dylan, our TBM, earlier. I was thinking that the 49ers were going to pull it out. We'll see on Sunday, but he's leaning towards the Eagles. So I think I just hope that the ankle's still hurting, and we'll see what happens. But weather-wise, we are looking at some wintry weather in the middle of the country. We're also looking at a big warm-up, a welcome warm-up in portions of the Southern Plains, into Texas, into the 70s and 80s in some spots. So that's the big weather headline today. That cold front's going to move off to the east as we head through out the next couple of days. We're looking at rain developing from the Ohio Valley into Texas. Stronger storms are possible along the Gulf Coast. And we say stronger storms mean the chance for tornadoes. Certainly some heavy rain falling as well tomorrow. And then this will all move to the east on Wednesday, and we're going to see some rain falling in the northeast. But look at this, a big-time warm-up. This is welcome compared to the frigid air we had last week. We're looking at temperatures feeling spring-like in many spots, into the 70s and 80s. Little Rock, 68 degrees, at 16 degrees above what is typical for this time of year. Houston into the mid-70s, New Orleans, 73, Tallahassee, 73. And we are looking at temperatures into the 60s and 70s, also in portions of the Mid-Atlantic. Atlantic City, you're going to be near 50 degrees tomorrow. That's 5 degrees above normal, and we're going to keep it warm as we head towards the rest of the week. Into Friday, we're looking at temperatures into the upper 50s in New York City. So, Jonathan, I'm curious about your thoughts. What do you think? Eagles, Kansas City.
I think it's going to be a tight game. I'm leaning towards the Chiefs in a close game, but I hope for your sake the Eagles win. So good luck to you and your squad. Michelle Grossman, thank you so very much for being with us this morning. Still ahead, what we can expect from President Biden's State of the Union address tomorrow, including his plans to draw a contrast between his leadership so far and the state of the Republican Party. Back in a moment with that. You're hearing the crowd chant at President Biden on Friday at the Democratic National Committee's annual winter meeting in Philadelphia ahead of tomorrow night's State of the Union address. The president is expected to talk about the economy and how it's in better shape now than when Donald Trump left the White House. He'll also talk about overseas alliances and point to bipartisanship, explaining that both parties can accomplish a lot when they work together. Much of the speech will center around the president making his case for re-election, but he is not expected to actually announce a bid for 2024. That announcement is expected to come later this month, or perhaps, more likely, sliding into March or April. That timeline keeps shifting. Following the president's address, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders will deliver the Republican response. Capitol Police and the Secret Service are installing a fence around the U.S. Capitol ahead of the State of the Union. Construction of that temporary fence began yesterday. A senior congressional aide tells NBC News it costs about $1 million to install and remove the barrier. The fence has gone up several times since the January 6th insurrection, including for last year's State of the Union address. Joining us now, White House reporter for Politico, Lauren Egan. She is also co-author of the must-read West Wing Playbook. Lauren, thanks so much for being here this morning. Big night tomorrow. It's the biggest audience any president will address all year long. He's certainly not going to announce 2024, but he's going to draw some real contrast, aides have said, between what he's done and what we're seeing for the new incendiary leadership in the Republican House. What else should we expect to hear from the president tomorrow night?
That's right. I think that tomorrow is going to be a lot of looking back at what President Biden has done in the first 2 years that he was in office. I think there's a real acknowledgement that there probably is not going to be a ton of legislative wins going forward. So I expect to hear a lot of infrastructure talk. I do think that he's probably going to touch on things like Roe versus Wade, police reform, assault weapons ban, things that probably we're not going to see a ton of progress on in the next few years, but that's kind of the point, to show that look what we've been able to get done these past few years when I was working with Republicans, Democrats and Republicans working together. And now that we have this new class of House Republicans on Capitol Hill, that progress is going to slow down. If you remember back to last year, there was hecklers at the president's State of the Union. I think the White House would be quite pleased if that were to happen again, because that's really making their case for them that, look, President Biden is a steady, easy hand. The Republican Party is a totally different story. That's what, you know, they're arguing.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, exactly. And Lauren Boebert, among them. We just saw some of President Biden's speech on Friday at the DNC annual meeting. We're going to play a little bit more now.
Real simple. Republicans try to cut Social Security. It's not going to get by the Senate, in my view, but I'll stop them. If they try to cut Medicare, I'll stop them. I got a veto pen. They try to pass the 30% national sales tax, I'll stop them. And if they send me a national ban on the right to choose, I will stop them.
So, Lauren, the president has been leaning into that message quite a bit recently. Do we think that would be what we'd hear from him on the campaign trail this year and next, were he to jump in?
I think the White House certainly hopes that that's the campaign message that they can have. That was, you know, not an announcement, but that speech felt as close to an announcement as we could possibly come to. I think it's really remarkable when you look at just where we were a few months ago with the president. It really seemed like there might be some efforts among Democrats to maybe look for a different candidate. And the president has really been able to solidify his hold on the party. And that's a strong place for him going into the State of the Union tomorrow.
Yeah, there seem to be no credible challengers out there. It is Biden or bust, as some said on Friday in Philadelphia. And finally, one of your latest posts for West Wing Playbook dives into how President Biden, sort of quietly, but he's had a lot of success with judicial appointments and has undone a lot of what President Trump had put forth. But you say that momentum is starting to slow down. So tell us what he's done so far, but why is it that he might not be as successful going forward?
Yeah, that's right. He's had really remarkable success in getting judges confirmed in his first 2 years in office. It's been a lot of diverse judges, a lot of women, a lot of black judges, but that pace is slowing down. And that's because of this rule called the blue slip, which is this, you know, tradition in the Senate where home state senators have to, literally as a piece of paper, a blue slip, provide their sign off on nominees for their state. And what the Biden White House has done these first 2 years is really go for those low hanging fruit. Gone for judges that are in states where there are two Democratic senators. So now what they have left are judges that they need to confirm in states where it's either two Republicans or one Republican and one Democrat. So this is sort of kind of the story of the Biden presidency right now, right? Like he's got to figure out a way to get these Republicans on board. And that is going to be a really, really steep hill to climb.
Well, certainly we'll hear from him. Notes of bipartisanship, whether it actually happens or not, a harder call. Lauren Egan from Politico, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Still ahead, we're going to turn to CNBC next for an early look at what's driving the day on Wall Street. Plus, inflation and climbing interest rates push credit card debt among consumers to record highs. This morning's top business headlines are next. Welcome back. In time now for business. And for that, let's bring in CNBC's Jumana Bersece, who joins us live from London. Jumana, great to see you. Investors are awaiting more earnings news this week, as well as an important speech from the most interesting man in the world, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. What should we expect?
I'm glad you think he's the most interesting person in the world, because I certainly do. That is right. So on Tuesday, we're looking forward to that speech out of the Fed Chair Jerome Powell, as well as President Biden's State of the Union address. But also another big earnings week is coming up. So far, about 50% of the S&P have reported. So there's still another 50% to go. This week, we're going to get earnings from the likes of DuPont, Chipotle, Disney and PepsiCo, some of the names to watch out for. But worth bearing in mind that we did see a solid week for stock markets last week. The Nasdaq was up more than 3%, 3.4 percentage points for the week last week. S&P up 1.6. even though we had that very strong jobs report on Friday coming in way higher than anyone expected, 517,000 jobs created, the unemployment rate at a 53-year low, which is leading some investors to think that perhaps the Fed can afford to keep rates restrictive for a little bit longer. So don't this speech on Tuesday is going to be very, very important.
Yeah, it remains this odd dilemma where more jobs, but yet that could send interest rates higher. This sort of these mixed messaging on the economy. We'll certainly be covering that all week long. Let's go to a different headline here. A California jury has ruled that Elon Musk, not as interesting as Joe Powell, is not liable for losses experienced by Tesla's shareholders following his controversial funding secured tweet back in 2018. Tell us what all this means.
Yeah. Yeah, so very interesting. The jury didn't have to deliberate for very long. It only took them an hour to exonerate Elon Musk from any wrongdoing. And remember, this is a class action lawsuit that a bunch of investors filed against Elon Musk, against that August 2018 tweet, when he tweeted that funding had been secured to take Tesla private. Now, of course, the deal never happened. But in the run-up to that, a lot of investors bet on it actually happening, but it never happened. So many of them were sitting on losses of over billions of dollars. But in this case, it was difficult to prove that Elon Musk had a fraudulent intention. He did say that he had conversations with the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund, and his impression was that he did have the means to take the company private, even though it never actually materialized. So he tweeted, of course, he took to his favorite medium on Friday, saying he is deeply appreciative of the jury's decision. Worth bearing in mind that Musk had already paid $40 million in settlement fees to the SEC on back of this same story.
And lastly, according to the latest report from the credit agency TransUnion, total credit card debt hit a record high in the fourth quarter of last year. What does that tell us about consumer spending and inflation?
Yeah, quite a worrying development there, John. So credit card spending was up 18.5 percentage points from a year ago, a record debt of $930 billion for 2022 at a whole. Also, bear in mind that because interest rates have been rising, the average credit card rate is about 20% now. Just to give you context here, if you were to pay the minimum payment every month, it would take you 17 years to pay off your debt with a 20% interest rate. And the reason people are leaning more on their credit cards is simply because of the cost of living crisis. Because inflation has been hitting people's spending, they're leaning on their credit cards to buy things like food and groceries and even in some case utility bills. So not a very good development there.
No, not at all. CNBC's Jumana Bracece, live from London. Thank you for joining us this morning. Up next, Republican criticism for how President Biden handled the Chinese spy balloon shot down off the coast of South Carolina. And then coming up on Morning Joe, we'll have live reporting from Beijing on what China's saying about the matter. And also ahead, as I mentioned earlier, DNC Chair Jamie Harrison will join the conversation to discuss the Democrats' new primary calendar. Plus, we're going to hear from New York City Mayor Eric Adams as thousands of asylum seekers threaten to overwhelm the city's already strained shelter system. Plus, Mika's conversation with Pamela Anderson. Morning Joe is a few moments away. Welcome back. Unsurprisingly, President Joe Biden's response to the Chinese spy balloon situation is being met with criticism from some Republican lawmakers. Across the Sunday news shows yesterday, Republicans from both the House and Senate blasted the White House for its response, even while acknowledging that they still lacked all the facts.
There may be some unique attributes to it that I'm not aware of yet, but we'll learn more about this week. The dereliction of duty begins with this. Why not on Tuesday or Wednesday? You know people are going to see this. At some point, you're going to have to disclose it. And his failure to do so is, I don't understand that. I don't understand why he wouldn't do that. And that is the beginning of dereliction of duty. And the second is, we have to act swiftly on these things.
Letting a Chinese surveillance balloon lazily drift over America is like seeing a robber on your front porch and inviting him in, showing him where you keep your safe, where you keep your guns, where your children sleep at night, and then politely asking him to leave.
What began as a spy balloon has become a trial balloon, testing President Biden's strength and resolve. And unfortunately, the president failed that test. And that's dangerous for the American people.
We should note that officials say that three different Chinese balloons were spotted over the United States during President Trump's administration. None of those were shot down. Joining us now, former FBI special agent and national security analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, our friend Clint Watts. Clint, thanks for being here. Let's talk about this balloon. I mean, you know, we know that Chinese and other countries have spy satellites. They've got drones, other technologies. But why would a balloon be used? Is there any clarity at all as to what it was being used for? What could they glean from it?
Jonathan, I don't think we really know why they went this route. As we've seen from many of the Pentagon reports, a Chinese satellite could probably do everything that a balloon could do, at least from an imagery standpoint. I think that's one of the curiosities that hopefully we'll get some clarity on here in the coming days and weeks is, was it being used to measure or do some form of intelligence collection other than just straight imagery? In the intelligence community, it's known as measurements and signatures intelligence, or MASINT. I think that's one of the open questions, at least I have, is there some reason that they needed to use a balloon rather than a satellite? Because it's kind of a very old-fashioned way to do collection. As you can see, we were watching it from the ground. You have footage of it. So it wasn't going to go undetected all the way across the country. It seems a little bit ridiculous. So they put themselves in kind of a weird political quagmire over intelligence. I can't understand, at least from what we know so far, intelligence that would not seem to be very useful or different from what you could get from even open source satellite imagery that we would get on the internet. So I'm hoping when the debris is recovered, or maybe the Pentagon already knows, we can get some sort of clarity about what this balloon was trying to do.
And certainly seems a setback to relations between Beijing and Washington. I mean, the Secretary of State Blinken's trip, that was going to be a big deal. And now, of course, canceled. So, I mean, Clint, you know, obviously, look, countries spy on each other. But in what ways is the United States national security perhaps being threatened by an incident like this? And is there anything at all the U.S. can do to prevent this from happening again outside of shooting down the next balloon that shows up?
Yeah, Jonathan, it's just a weird provocation. I'm not sure what gains were really intended, or, you know, maybe in some weird way it was to send a message or to test U.S. reaction to these sorts of things. Tensions are rising with China across the board, and I think there's bipartisan consensus about China that they're the next big challenger to the United States. You're hearing, even in the Navy, some of the statements being made in the Navy and the Air Force, that they are really preparing for a potential war against China, which is quite shocking to hear that said so overtly and out in the open. So things are shifting. That China pivot that we talked about in the Obama administration, it's now playing out very heavily in the Biden administration. And this just raises the tensions across the board at a time where China is as well still critical part of the supply chain. You know, for most U.S. goods, we still have ripple effects in the economy over the zero COVID policy back in China, which has just been coming to an end. So I can't think of a worse time for China to do something like this. And I just don't know what the gains were. In the future, I imagine the U.S. will come up with a new strategy for intercepting these balloons before they get over the continental U.S. It is a valid concern. Shooting down one of these over the ground would potentially put people at risk. You just don't know where the debris is going to fall. You know, the pattern, I think they said, was 7 miles for this one. I've seen aircraft crash from great heights with the debris field up of 10 to 20 miles sometimes. So those sorts of concerns are always going to be top of mind, public safety for Americans. So really it comes down to defense, maybe out over the Pacific Ocean or other locations if this were to happen again.
And the payload of this balloon was equivalent to about 3 buses. So that's a lot. And that would have obviously hurt people. And Clint, we should also note this comes at the same time as new reporting about how Chinese state-run enterprises were getting around sanctions and doing business with Russian defense contractors. So still helping Russia with their war effort in Ukraine. There's going to be a lot of scrutiny on Beijing in the days ahead. We really appreciate you being here. Clint Watts, former FBI special agent and national security analyst. Thank you. Joining us now here on set in Washington with a look at Axios AM, the co-founder of Axios, Mike Allen. Mike, good to see you. What is the Axios One Big Thing today?
Well, Jonathan, the Axios One Big Thing is the balloon crashes.
Not a surprise.
The balloon crashes the State of the Union. So, as you know, months and months of preparation going into a State of the Union with one desire, send a clear message, right? Like President Biden talked before about the unity agenda. But now you have the ultimate disruptor. And this was a time when the administration, as you know, had planned to be talking about new overtures, connections with China, first Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, then the Secretary of State. Now, suddenly, President Biden finds himself on the defensive. And you saw him in that tape this weekend, right, when he's insisting that he was the one that wanted to shoot down the balloon sooner than military waited. So he's been hawkish on China. But now Republicans have an opening. They're saying it still should have been sooner.
Right. And the messaging from this White House was going to be drawing contrasts between them and the new Republicans in control of the House. There would be an overture for bipartisanship, certainly touting infrastructure and such. But you're right. You know, this will be at least something of a disruption, much like, of course, last year, his State of the Union was delivered just after Russia invaded Ukraine.
Right. And of course, China feasting on this, soaking it in, whether or not was the intention a consequence of this, is they're seeing how United States gears grind, right? They see how we respond to things, our timeline for responding to things, our decibel for responding to things, the pressure on President Biden, all super useful to an adversary.
So let's talk about the moves from the DNC. The Democratic Party passed this new presidential primary calendar, putting South Carolina first. We know that New Hampshire raising their hand in objection, but this seems to be all about creating a glide path for President Joe Biden's reelection.
It does, and perhaps in the future for Vice President Harris. So this empowers black voters both in South Carolina and Michigan. And for your viewers, pulling back the camera, what you and I have experienced as long as we've been alive, a clear presidential calendar of New Hampshire and Iowa up front. What's different this year is Republicans and Democrats now on track to have different calendars. So you see Nikki Haley, as she launches her Republican presidential race this year, going to Iowa, New Hampshire, different schedule for Democrats.
Yeah, and I think it'll be fascinating to see the play out. Republicans, no interest in changing their calendar. Right. They think Iowa represents their voters.
And you mentioned New Hampshire. Democrats are afraid that suddenly a very blue state is in play. President Biden in trouble in polling in New Hampshire. New Hampshire Democrats, as part of their squawking, are saying, you're putting a safe state in play in 24.
So you, Axios has a new analysis about 60 black lawmakers elected to Congress this year. 30 represent states or districts with a plurality of white voters. What can you tell us about that dramatic
shift? Pause and listen to that statement. So that's a real breaking of a historic barrier. Long black voters sent black members to Congress. Now you have half of the black members. And by the way, that's the most black lawmakers in history. Half of them are from states or districts that are white. So we're seeing a change there. And look at the power that those members have. You have the House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, a broad ideological spectrum. So this is a real change both in power, in optics, and in numbers.
And reflects the changing Democratic Party. We also, of course, have a few black senators, Cory Booker and Raphael Warnock, who cruised to re-election, as well as Governor of Maryland, rising star Wes Moore.
And on the Republican side, you have a senator from South Carolina, Senator Scott, who's mentioned as a presidential or vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Mike Allen, thank you so much
for
joining us this morning.
Happy SOTU week.
Yes, it is. State of the Union week. And we're going to have complete coverage all week long. We appreciate you getting up way too early with us on this Monday morning. Morning Joe will start after a quick final break.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.